and I'm recording this call so that people who are not on the call will have a link later to be able to listen to it. If you'd like a link to the call, email us, and we will send it to you. I'm Ori Neer. I'm an APN spokesman here in Washington, and our guest today is Professor Shibli Talhami. He's America's leading expert on public opinion in the Arab world. He's the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution here in Washington. Professor Talhami has been running a tracking post in the Arab world and in Israel and the occupied territories for more than a decade now. His newest book, released earlier this month, analyzes the results of these polls, these tracking polls, in the light of the current tumult in the region. The book is titled The World Through Arab Eyes, Arab Public Opinion and the Reshaping of the Middle East. I just finished reading it, actually, just a few days ago, and I highly recommend it. For us, people who care deeply about the Arab-Israeli and Israeli-Palestinian conflict and about Arab-Israeli peace, there are several important insights in the book, and they will be featured in our conversation today, albeit not exclusively. If there's one concept, one takeaway from the book, a term that Professor Talhami has coined years ago, actually, it is the prism of pain. That is the prism through which Arabs tend to view the world. And I've asked Professor Talhami to focus in his introductory remarks on that prism of pain. Following his remarks, I will ask him a couple of questions, and then we will have an open discussion with questions from the participants. Before we start, just a quick reminder to those of you who have not been with us in our recent briefing calls about the way in which we take questions. So anytime during the call, including during the introductory remarks, you may dial 5-star. That is the number 5, the digit 5 followed by the star sign, and that will signal to me that you are that you would like to ask a question. You will hear a recorded voice saying hand raised, which means that you have virtually raised your hand. I will then, during the Q&A, call on you to ask your question. Once you hear a recorded voice saying line unmuted, you will know that you are the next to ask a question. The way to do it is by dialing 5-star. So I would like to thank Professor Shibli Talhami for joining us. Thank you, Professor, and the floor is yours.
Well, thanks very much, Uri. Appreciate this opportunity. And I have to say that I'm an admirer of Americans for Peace now. And there was a time, in fact, when I wrote a letter of support for a fundraiser for the organization, because I've always admired the commitment to peace, both because it is principled and morally right, but it also because it is prudent in the sense of advancing the interests of both Arabs and Israelis in the long term. So I really appreciate it. It's very hard to be pro-peace when most people think it isn't going to happen, and you get dismissed and you get ignored, and you stay the course, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you, Professor.
I would like, as Uri said, the book is really extensive, and the Arab-Israeli issue, of course, is the central issue in the Arab world, and it's there, but it's much broader than that, obviously, and it deals with issues from evolving Arab identity to the role of the media and how it's impacting attitudes broadly to the views on women and religion and world powers. And so it's a very broad book, but I want to focus just on this one theme about the role of the Arab-Israeli issue. And as Uri suggested, I call this issue the prism of pain through which Arabs view the world. And I want to just clarify some things about that concept and then tell you why I think it is so central. First of all, when I say it is the prism of pain through which Arabs see the outside world, I don't mean that an Egyptian woman or a Moroccan young man wake up in the morning thinking Israel, Palestine, or America, for that matter. They think about, what they're going to do that day, what they're going to put food on the family, jobs, education, everything, the ordinary lives of people. But this issue is central as a frame of reference for how Arabs evaluate what's good and bad about the world, their heroes and their villains. And there are multiple reasons for it, and there is certainly a lot of evidence for it. For example, the book, which is based on a whole decade of polling before and after the Arab uprisings, very clearly shows that Arab attitudes toward the U.S. specifically are largely based on their evaluation of American policy on this issue. It shows that how Arabs pick their heroes in the world, the most admired leaders in the world, ranging from Jacques Chirac to Hassan Nasrallah to Hugo Chavez, have only one thing in common, and that is when they see them to be friendly on the Palestinian issue or confrontational with Israel. So there's a lot of data that supports this view. The question is why. Is that the case? And is that likely to change, particularly in the Arab uprisings, when, in fact, people are really kind of focused on huge events happening in the Arab world and sometimes tragedies that certainly surpass any tragedy that's occurring at the moment? And the Palestinian question just witnessed the horror in Syria that is heartbreaking, and certainly witnessed what's happening in Egypt that is incredibly consequential for Egyptians and the rest of the region. So sometimes it is easy to say, well, therefore it's not important. But let me give you one example that just happened yesterday and the day before. The day before yesterday, the Emir of Qatar abdicated. It's an extraordinary thing. It was a rare event in the Arab world. I think most of you know the longevity of Arab rulers. This was a 61-year-old man who certainly was at the peak of his power, and he was abdicating. One of the things that was striking about his abdication speech, it was really brief and there was minimal boasting. But immediately after he finished his speech, Al Jazeera went to two Qatari commentators who were close to the Qatari leadership to get their views. And right after that, Al Jazeera broke and went to the commentator in the West Bank and then another commentator in Gaza to get the first reaction. The day after that, the new Qatari emir, Sheikh Tamim bin Khalifa, gave his inaugural speech. It was a little bit longer, and he talked broadly about Qatari foreign policy and what Qatar is likely to do, which is more continuity. But he spoke about no issue in detail except the Palestine issue, and he spoke of no commitment of Qatar to foreign policy issues except this specific issue. And so you might ask the question, why are they doing that? Well, they're doing that because they understand this is the prism of pain through which Arabs are evaluating. And that's how they got Al Jazeera to succeed, because Al Jazeera, in the end, understood its audiences and catered to them. That's why it's successful. It's not because it shapes opinion, but because it reflects the aspirations of the people. And there are four broad reasons, I think, why this issue remains the prism of pain. The first, I think it's sometimes misunderstood, because Egyptians are, of course, they feel strongly about Egypt, and Moroccans feel strongly about Morocco. But what we see in all the polling, particularly over the decade, that transnational identity remains stronger than identification with the state in the Arab world. More people say they're either Muslim or Arab first than they say they're Egyptian, Jordanian, or Moroccan first. And more importantly, when you ask people whether they want the state, whether they think the role of the government is to serve only its citizens or to serve the interests of Muslims and Arabs even outside of that state, you have half or more people in every country say to serve the interests of Muslims and Arabs outside. So, in essence, yes, they want food on the table, they want jobs, they want the government to be democratic, they want to be respected by the government, but their notion of respect and dignity, which is, of course, the driving force, is not just dignity in the relationship with the ruler, but dignity between their country and the rest of the world, particularly on Arab and Muslim issues, and that remains to be the case. Second, I view this
Palestine question for historical reasons as part of the core Arab identity. It is, in some ways, a metaphor for the collective Arab humiliation that is part of the driving forces in the Arab world that want change and respect and dignity. And in part because of its history, in part because it remains an open wound through which, on which Arabs seemingly have no control, no ability to control it. The governments haven't been able to do anything about it. And it flares up every other day almost on one issue or the other, as we know this week, just this week, you know, the decision to build in East Jerusalem is just another example of the sort of things that they view day in and day out, and they feel they can't do anything about it. It's still a symptom of their sense of collective humiliation. And if the Arab uprisings are really about dignity, this issue remains dignity's antithesis. It is core to them. But second, I think part of the reason why it is particularly an issue that shapes their views of the United States, you can argue, is the success of American foreign policy and maybe the success of Israeli foreign policy. You might think that is strange, but it isn't. You know that our politicians, members of Congress, presidents, vice presidents, Israeli politicians, have this motto, which is there is no light between Israel and the United States. There shouldn't be any light between Israel and the United States. In part, this is seen as sending a message that America will be supportive and there is no differences. And therefore, when you're facing Israel, you're facing America. It is understandable. It is a tendency, particularly on Israelis, to want this, but certainly in terms of, people who would want support for Israel. Well, guess what? It worked. And over the past decade, in fact, it's very hard to find a discourse in the Arab world that differentiates Israel from the U.S. They come in the same sentence. And when they're blaming Israel, they're blaming the U.S. It comes in the same places. So what is the net result of that? The net result is when you're angry with Israel, as, you know, this week over the Jerusalem issue, you're angry with the U.S. It's inescapable. You can't really avoid that. It is just built into the structure of that relationship in the absence of Arab-Israeli peace. But here's the fourth point that specifically has to do with the absence of peace. Whenever you don't have peace, think of what Israeli security, how Israeli security is defined. It is inevitably defined in terms that Arabs will see as domination and therefore will reject them. What do I mean by that? Well, Israel is a small state, and obviously it feels it cannot lose any conflict or war even once. It's a country of 8 million people facing potentially 350 million Arabs. And so part of the Israeli doctrine is to have technological and military superiority over any combination of Arab states, and to maintain that and to show it over and over again, and to have what is called escalation dominance. And on that, the United States is on record as supporting it, and in terms of policy is supporting it, and is repeated by presidents and vice presidents of our congressional leaders. And there is no difference in Israel between left and right on this. Everybody understands that in the absence of peace between Israel and the Arabs, that is a security survival imperative. So start with that, but now look at it from the Arab side. Look at the side of the Arabs who want to be empowered, who want to play what they think is rightful role in politics, who don't want to be dominated, who are rejecting world domination, even Western domination. And in essence, you're telling them that they have to accept this domination of a country of 8 million over 350 million. They will totally reject it in the era of the uprisings and empowerment, and they will continually reject it, even if they give up on the Palestinians, because, you know, they may not believe any longer that the solution is possible or that the Palestinians can be, you know, successful in their endeavor. But the absence of peace means that the targeting, the conflict with Israel will escalate, and it will be a source of the resentment. In a way, it will become the new paradigm of their relationship in the region. So I think we have to understand that's why this issue is so important in shaping the attitudes in the region toward not just Israel, but broadly internationally. Let me just end with just a couple of points about where Arabs are on the issue of peace with Israel. As Uri suggested, I also do polling in Israel, and I have quite a bit of information on that, if you would like, both among Jews and among Arabs on these issues. But I'm going to limit myself here to the Arab attitudes on this issue. Two things are worth noting. The first thing is that since the Arab uprising, certainly in 2011-2012, both after the beginning of the 2010 uprisings, there is no noticeable difference in the degree of support of Arabs to two-state solution. You still have a majority of Arabs, roughly the same percentage, is actually almost two-thirds, in principle supportive of a two-state solution based on the 67 borders. That has not changed remarkably. But what we have seen is the expansion of a majority of people who now believe the two-state solution will never happen at all. And that second conclusion is really particularly central because I think it frames their attitude in every way. And I think it's true of the Israelis, of course, who also, and according to my polls, the majority of whom also don't believe the two-state solution is possible. That not only frames their capacity to compromise, because if you really don't think it's going to happen, if you enter in negotiations and you think that the next morning you're going to have conflict, you're preparing for failure, you're not preparing for success, and when you're preparing for failure, you're an idiot if you make a concession. So it certainly frames the receptivity to making any concession when you have that assessment. But even it goes deeper than that, and I have a chapter in the book that I call Empathy and Incitement and Public Opinion, because one of the things that we don't understand is empathy simply cannot be taught, because it is when you are in intense conflict, the absence of empathy is structural. In some ways, it is those warring parties feel they shouldn't empathize, because if they do, it'll weaken them if they have to have an inevitable fight. And the same thing can be said about incitement. We think it is just a question of fighting the people who are inciting. It doesn't work, because public toleration for incitement is also a function of whether they think conflict is inevitable or not. Because if they think it is inevitable, they see incitement as a useful mechanism to mobilize people to fight an inevitable fight. So we don't quite understand the consequences of this mood that has taken hold, that contrasts sharply with the 1990s, when the 1990s most people thought conflict was coming to an end, whether they liked it or not, and they basically positioned themselves accordingly. Now they position themselves in quite the other places. Now, my own view and take on people is, yes, of course, you have people in every society, whether it's Arabs or Jews or Americans or Chinese, who will never empathize, or who are maximalists, or you can't win them and you can't talk with them. Every society has some of those. And you have people on the left who will not allow themselves to be undermined by prospects, and they will be in principle or for moral reasons be committed to reconciliation. It's something hard to do, like Americans for Peace Now or Peace Now itself, which is sustained even when prospects look dim, to stay the course. A very small number of people can do that. But the majority of people are not black and white. They can change from one to the next. And when they say, they can't empathize, it is in part not because they have dark hearts, but because the hearts darken when conflict seems inevitable. And we've seen that in the 1990s when after Oslo, only a minority of Palestinians supported violence against Israelis. and only a tiny minority of Israelis supported expelling Palestinians. How quickly and dramatically that changed in just a couple of months after the collapse of the negotiations in 2000. So hearts certainly shift with major events, but that is a much harder thing to do, and it cannot simply be done by just going back to negotiations like Secretary Kerry is trying to do. It needs something more profound, because what we have now is seemingly hardened views that cannot be swayed simply by return to the negotiating table. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Tohani. This was quite a lot. And I thought that maybe I'd actually start with a question. Maybe what I'll do first, actually, is remind our participants that in order to ask a question, in order to raise their hand, they should dial 5-star. So 5-star, it'll signal to me that you want to ask a question, and I will call on you later. What I wanted to ask you first actually doesn't have much to do with Arab attitudes per se, but more with attitudes in the administration, the U.S. administration. And what I mean by that is, I wonder if you agree with me, it seems like there is a recognition, a greater recognition in the administration, A, that Arab public opinion matters, and B, that Arab public opinion impacts immediately on the way the U.S. is perceived, and therefore on the U.S.'s ability to make a difference in the region. And that is related to the way the U.S. is doing business on the on Israeli-Palestinian peace brokership. In the past, I think it was perceived in Washington that the United States is brokering peace between Israel and Palestinians, mostly because out of a kind of a benevolent attitude. We can't want it more than the parties themselves was the attitude, and so on. Now I think it has changed, and I think that there is a greater perception in Washington that if we return to the idea of the prism of pain, that Arabs view their relationship with the United States through that prism of pain of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and therefore the Israeli-U.S. relationship. So just wondering if you could comment a little about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is an interesting question. As you know, Uri, just 6 months ago, I published a co-authored book with Dan Kurtzer and Bill Quant, Steve Spiegel, and Scott Lisinski that we work on for 6 years called The Peace Puzzle, American Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace from 1989 to 2011, which we really looked at archival materials. We interviewed every conceivable major participant, and we reached conclusions. But one of the things that were really surprising to me personally, even though I was close, in some cases I was part of side negotiating committees, when I looked at the collapse of the Camp David negotiations, and I drafted that chapter on it, when you looked at Bill Clinton, you know, here is a man who clearly is very smart. He became sort of an expert on international affairs. He didn't start that way. And he had this capacity to empathize, at least projects that in ways that no other can. And yet, when you analyze his diplomacy on the Arab-Israeli issue, what you find is that he never genuinely believed that Arab-Israeli peace is essential for American national security policy. This is really shocking in some ways. He either did it because initially he thought it was an opportunity, it's good for Israel, it might also be good for the Arabs. It might bring some good for America, and it certainly would be good for his legacy. But there was never really an internalized, thought that this was strategically important for America. And that showed in many of the policies. For example, there were no major studies of the consequences of failure of Camp David or getting an interagency review or doing any of that sort. When he looked at consequences, he looked mostly at political consequences. My own view is you cannot mediate Arab-Israeli peace effectively if you're the United States of America, unless you really believe it's genuinely a national interest of the United States, that therefore you must push even if the parties resist. The smarter, which you can't have it more than the parties themselves. Well, I don't even know what that means, because the parties desperately want to talk to Israelis and Arabs. It's, we're talking about governments who are incapable of wanting it. And if it is in American interest, you got to find a way to push through with it. And so I think at some level, this president, Obama, and this Secretary of State, Kerry, and as you know, I advised the Obama administration. I was a senior advisor to George Mitchell in the first administration. And I served on Kerry's campaign as the chair of the Task Force on Relations with the Muslim World. And I know that they both fully understand that this issue is consequential for American foreign policy, that it is central. So in some ways, you start with something different. Now, whether that's also been enhanced by the Arab uprisings, I think it probably has. The question is, do they understand what it means, therefore, in terms of what needs to be done, and are they prepared to pay a price for doing it? Because you can't have it on the cheap. We all know that, you know, both in the relations with Arabs and in relation with Israelis. A peace requires a compromise, and frankly, in relation with Congress, in relation with our domestic politics. And you need to mobilize people, and you need to push for it, and therefore you subordinating some other issues. I am not sure, and I see no clear evidence that they have thought this through enough. Mm-hmm. I don't see the evidence yet.
Mm-hmm. But you do know the players. You know Kerry quite well, and you know the president, and you know their teams. You if I understand correctly, you are convinced that they have the conviction. It's just a question of whether they have the wherewithal to continue.
Yeah,
that.
Yes, I think they have the conviction.
Okay.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I think they have the conviction now. You know, they believe it's an important American national security interest. That is, Arab-Israeli peace is American national security interest. I have no doubt about that in my mind, that they genuinely believe that. The question is, of course, there are a lot of other national security interests the U.S. is facing now,
right.
How they place it in that priority, and have they really figured out what it entails operationally, I'm not sure.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to open the floor for questions now. Again, just to remind you, you dial 5-star to ask the question. Our first question comes from Frank Bamberger. Go ahead, Frank.
Professor Tahami, it's a pleasure to hear you. You mentioned at the beginning that Arabs generally place their Arab-Muslim identity ahead of their national identity. Is this equally true of Palestinians?
Very interesting. Very interesting question. By the way, just to clarify. When you, an Egyptian, of course, is simultaneously an Egyptian and Arab and a Muslim or a Christian, and the same thing can be said of everybody. They're all these things. They're not just a choice of one at the expense of the others. The question that we ask, and we have seen the trend, starts, in fact, with the thing, we know that you can be all these things, but which one is more important to you today? So we in some ways force them to make a choice, and when we did, what we've seen over the decade is not only that more people say either Muslim or Arab than they say their affiliate, you know, their relationship with the state, but we've seen that the affinity with the state has declined over the decade in relative terms. And now there's variations in the Arab world, by the way. Not every country is the same. For example, Lebanon surprisingly has the strongest state affinity. And Saudi Arabia has by far the weakest state affinity. So there are variations, and I want to just clarify that. But Palestinians, it's interesting, by the way, it's not just Palestinians, but even Palestinian citizens of Israel, Arab citizens of Israel, because I've been studying that identity as well, and I can be happy to tell you more about it if there's time. But in general, it's interesting the relationship of the Palestinians with, I have not measured specifically Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, because that's not a region that I directly study. I review other works like Felicia Coffey's on it. But historically, just to give you an example, of in 19, right after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. And if you recall, the PLO was expelled from Lebanon, and the Palestinians were really furious with the Arabs' inability to help them. And Arafat, when he left Beirut, he went first to Cyprus. And while he was being invited to go first to an Arab capital because everybody wanted to show that they survived and that's a victory just by surviving. And they were so angry that they didn't, and they moved the headquarters of the PLO magazine, Palestina Thawra, into Cyprus as well. They didn't want to move it into an Arab country. And I recall in the debate, they had people writing to the magazine a couple of issues later, including from Saudi Arabia, saying, Palestine is the issue of the Arabs, and how come you're going to a non-Arab country? And the editor replying, yeah, maybe it's the issue of the Arab, but where are the Arabs helping us in the war? So you'd get the impression that they were feeling more Palestinian than Arabs. And yet, the lead story in that magazine by the editors was a Palestinian is first Arab and second Arab and third Palestinian. So it's really interesting in part because Palestinians, while they have a strong Palestinian identity, an increasing one, they think that the strength of their cause is by being tied to Arab and Islamic identity. And I suspect if you ask a member of Hamas, and I haven't done so, or some of the people in Gaza who support Hamas, you might get saying Islamic identity is stronger.
Frank, did you have a follow-up? Or
just to ask, that a lot of the polls that you rely on are available publicly?
Yes, they are. We actually have on our website, sadat.umd.edu, we have polls from multiple years, including the ones we do among Israeli Jews and among Israeli Arabs and in the six Arab countries we study. And also, by the way, we have a poll among Americans on the Middle East. So I have a lot of analysis of changing American attitudes toward the Arab-Israeli issue itself, and it's in the book. In fact, there's a whole chapter in the book on changing American attitudes on the Arab-Israeli issue. And in the book itself, just to go back to this issue of identity, in the chapter on identity, there's a whole analysis of Arab citizens of Israel and how they identify themselves in terms of Arab, Israeli, Palestinian, Christian, Druze, or Muslim, and why. And it's a complex story there that I think you probably would enjoy reading given your interest, because there's a lot of data on it, and I cite the data and I have graphs in the book as well.
I'm looking forward.
If I remember correctly, Professor Tohani, on your website, the data is presented in an eye-opening PowerPoint presentation format.
We have both.
Yeah.
We have actually three formats. One is the PowerPoint, and then we have two formats for analysis for people who want to do something.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Our next question comes from Lucy in New York.
Hi. Thank you, Professor, for speaking with us today.
Did I get your name wrong? I'm sorry. What is your name?
No, I'm listening on with Lucy right now. This is Ben.
Okay.
We're at Encounter over in the Bikurim offices of the JFNA. So, question here, Professor. We were reading today about a protest starting up again in Egypt. In the last few weeks, we've heard King Abdullah of Jordan begging for some sort of help, rather from the UN or the US, dealing with the influx of refugees, saying that, he's increasingly losing order on the civil society in Jordan. What does it mean for the future of the peace process right now that the two Arab countries that are historically at peace with the State of Israel are no longer able to kind of rally their domestic society to a point where they can play an active mediating role? What does that outline for the future of American involvement in peace negotiations, and who else within the Muslim world can step up and be representative of the Palestinian people when coming to the negotiating table?
It's a good question, and I also think that the changes that are taking place in the region are huge and uncertain, and they, on at some level, they make things peace more difficult. At some levels, they actually open up opportunities, and it's a question of how you frame it and how you look at it. But let me tell you about the opportunities. Look at the Muslim Brotherhood and how they've behaved. Obviously, internally, they haven't behaved particularly successfully. They've been very weak, and look at the demonstrations they're likely to face on the 30th. That is, you know, it's probably the biggest demonstration since the revolution. But nonetheless, you know, you can see how they behaved on foreign policy. They may have a different feeling, but they don't want to be dragged into international confrontations, given the huge test that they have at home. And that's one reason why they've, you know, moved to kind of create, to help with the ceasefire and, in the confrontation with Israel. And Hamas, they've been collaborating to the extent possible militarily. They haven't done anything to endanger the Israeli Egyptian peace treaty. And certainly the king, despite everything, he's maintained his close relationship and everything, even with all the pressure. But his public, there's no question, is demanding, ends to normal relations with Israel to the extent that they exist. I think that all of these leaders are desperate to have quiet on the Arab-Israeli issue, because the minute there's a flare-up of any kind, then their inability to do anything about it weakens them. And you can see already against Morsi how people are, from people who used to be with Mubarak, are blaming him for now being, you know, in bed with Israel. And so these leaders don't want the Arab-Israeli issue to come up, and they don't want Israel to be involved. Look at what happened in Egypt, over Syria. You would think that, given that you have over 80% of Egyptians, according to my poll, support the rebels against the Assad regime, and then you have, you know, tens of thousands of Syrians already dead, we haven't seen any huge demonstration pertaining to that at all in Egypt. The only demonstration that was large scale that pertained to Syria was when Israel carried out an airplane attack on a facility outside Damascus, which was, you know, almost invisible. It was just reported, right? There were hardly any pictures of it or any real consequences. It just tells you how that issue still mobilizes, and I think these governments that have bigger fish to fry at home now, they actually would rather have that not flare up. So the real issue is, if there's something on the table now, can they go through with it? I think, yes, they can, if a deal along the lines that most people think would have to be done takes place and the Palestinians support it, I think Arab leaders will find a way to go behind it. On the Israeli side, by the way, I've always believed that despite the uncertainty, particularly with regards to Egypt, that it opens up a different kind of opportunity for Israel, which is that if you look historically at the Israeli strategy, yes, they wanted peace with other Arab states, but more than any other state, they wanted peace with Egypt, because only Egypt had the genuine capacity to fight Israel militarily effectively, and showed that, obviously, in 1973. And so the Israeli policy, really from 1948 all the way until peace was had in the 1970s, was focused on trying to find a way to take Egypt out of fighting coalition with Israel. And obviously now that's in question. And therefore, I think a revived Arab peace plan in conjunction with a Palestinian-Israeli agreement that now has Egypt reviving and revalidating its peace treaty with Israel has more value for Israeli public opinion than in the past. That's my feeling.
Thank you, Shibli. Well, you did comment about the attitudes among Arab citizens of Israel regarding their identity, which is something that I am personally very interested in. I'm sure that other people who are listening as well. So could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that we tried to do is find out, first of all, whether the attitudes of Arab citizens of Israel was remarkably different from Arabs outside on a host of issues, including identity. And we found that on many issues, particularly foreign policy issues, they're not all that far apart, including attitudes on Iran, attitudes on the U.S. There are differences, but the trends are roughly in the same direction. But on identity, we found really huge differences among the different sects of Arabs in Israel, Muslims, Christians, and Druze. In part, we found that if you're a Muslim, you're likely to either identify yourself either Muslim first or Palestinian first, and then Arab, and very few as Israeli, small number. If you are a Christian, you are likely to identify yourself Arab first, then Israeli, then Christian. If you're Druze, you are likely to identify yourself Druze first, then Israeli, then Arab, and obviously not Muslim. And yet, when we really looked more closely at this issue and also the issue of what they watch on television, because the Druze tended to watch Israeli television more, Muslims tended to watch Al Jazeera more. But when we broke it down to see what's behind that, we found that the single most important issue, both for identity and for what they watched on television, is whether or not they had relatives who became refugees in 1948. And it's fascinating because roughly half of Arab citizens of Israel had refugee relatives. And those half tended to be more Palestinian Arab and tended to watch Al Jazeera more and Israeli TV less and tended to identify themselves as Israeli less. It didn't matter whether they were Muslim, Christian, or Druze.
So their personal familial affinity with the Palestinian people was the determining factor.
Absolutely.
Amazing. How interesting. Our next question, which I think will be our last question, comes from Aaron. Are you with us, Aaron?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So, Professor Talami, you've spoken about how potential negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians are never really going to go anywhere unless they start to transform the perceptions on both sides of how they view each other, prospects for peace, generally. Is there anything in your polling that's kind of revealing or demonstrative how that might be accomplished?
That's a question that sounds like it's coming from a man by the name of Mem, right?
You are right. You are correct. This is Ori, yes.
All right. You know, let me just tell you what I meant by it, because I think we can see what happens when you have such deep suspicion and mistrust that even when you do something good, even when there is even some promise, but let's say Netanyahu says tomorrow, okay, I'm going to stop building in Jerusalem for the next 6 months, or I'm going to do this or that, which sounds from the Israeli point of view like a concession or a gesture, it will immediately be dismissed because you say, well, we don't trust it. We've heard it before. It's just there is nothing on that scale that can transform deep-seated mistrust, the likes of which has emerged over the past, really since 2000. And so what we're talking about is something far more radical than that. And what could that be? Obviously, you know, leadership. And if you look at how Arab-Israeli relations have been transformed, you can see, you know, wars have done that in 67, 73. They've changed attitudes for good or for bad. Leadership events such as, Sadat going to Jerusalem and Arafat and Rabin shaking hands, those were extraordinary events because the symbolism in them was transformative, and they did sway people one way or the other. They swayed, more importantly, people's assessment of whether it's possible to make peace or not. And so that's the kind of order of magnitude we're talking about. And so when you look at it and say,
what sort of thing might look like that, it's very hard to see. That's why a lot of people are pessimistic, because you say, well, can't imagine, you know, Netanyahu in theory is in a position to do it because he's got a lot of power. The weak party is very hard. It's very hard to envision what it can do that would be transformative. And you look at the Arab world, certainly in their turmoil, you can't imagine somebody from the Arab world outside of the Palestinian area is going to do something extraordinary. So this puts the onus mostly on the international community and obviously principally on the U.S. in the short term. And so what could the U.S. do that would be transformative? Obviously, one possibility is to put its own plan on the table in a big way. But that has risks, obviously, but I think there's the risk of failure that is almost inevitable if you don't try something. And then you also don't do it casually, because in order to, if you want to maximize the chance of success, you have to. You're going to have to build a coalition. You have to have a sustained strategy of winning people for it. You can't do it just in the dark. You have to mobilize the constituency in the U.S. You have to mobilize support in Congress. You have to prepare the public in the Middle East. And some people think, obviously, that the administration in some ways is already doing that by the president's speech in Jerusalem, Kerry's speech to the American Jewish Committee, Clinton's speech at the Paris conference, that all these were essentially, you know, components of sort of selling the issue that this is a critical conflict and time is running out and if we don't act now, it's going to be too late. You need to do more of that to make it happen.
We have time for one more question, a short question, a short answer from Morris Goodman. Go ahead, Morris.
Thank you. Friends to my right of me keep asking, how can you look for peace with the Palestinians when their charter still states that there is no recognition of the State of Israel? Is there anything that can touch that? Thank you.
I'm not really sure, you know, what charter people are specifically referring to. I guess the Hamas charter. You know, I've never been, you know, a fan of that kind of argument on the Arab side as well. When people said Likud hasn't changed its, you know, charter, or they still have the map of Greater Israel, or members of the Israeli government still don't believe that Palestinians should have a state. I mean, people take that as parties and politicians. In the end, it's all about what you're going to have in the agreement. You don't have peace until you have peace. So no Israeli government is going to be foolish enough to sign an agreement with Palestinians that doesn't accept Israel as a state and ends the conflict and ends all claims for the future. And they shouldn't, and they wouldn't. And so we're not talking about, you know, this kind of hypothetical. I mean, who would, you know, what government is going to sign a deal that doesn't have that instituted in the documents and backed by some international support? In this case, if you ever have a two-state solution, you know, almost inevitable, you're going to have some kind of backing, including perhaps international forces of some sort in a transition. I just can't imagine otherwise.
Thank you, Shibley. One last thing. Are you working on another poll or any other project that's coming up soon?
Well, I am. I'm certainly, as you know, one doesn't stop. I'm going to do a couple of polls in the fall, including one in Israel. Typically, I release a poll at the Saban Forum, which usually takes place in September, just to compare Israeli and Arab attitudes. And I've certainly started two book projects that I'm not ready to talk about yet.
Sounds like you're keeping yourself very busy. Before we end and before I thank you for joining us, I want to remind people of another briefing call that we will have on Thursday, July 11th, with APN founder Mark Rosenblum, who just came back from the region. He was, among other places, in Saudi Arabia, and is willing to share with us his impressions from his trip to the region. So this will be on Thursday, July 11th, and the exact time will be We will let you know the exact time in a subsequent email that we'll send out. Professor Tohami, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it, and I know the participants do too. And hopefully we'll hear from you soon.
Thanks, Uri. Thanks for hosting.
Thank you, and thank you for everyone for participating. This brings our briefing call to an end. Goodbye.